This recording was made on August the 12th, 1966, at the luncheon meeting of the membership of the Atlanta Employers Voluntary Merit Employment Association, commonly called MEA. The luncheon was held at the Dinkler Plaza Hotel. The Coca-Cola Company was host for the luncheon. The recording begins with Mr. Richard H. Horsey, Executive Vice President of the Atlanta Coca-Cola Bottling Company, introducing the guest speakers.
Employers, Atlanta's Merit Employment Association is made up of profit-seeking businesses, or businessmen, if you would bring this concept to life. I have noticed, perhaps to a decreasing extent in the most recent years, and perhaps less in Atlanta than in other communities, but nonetheless with some consistency, that within their own associations, businessmen tend to say things to each other that they like to hear, or things that they already know. And this often extends to the speakers businessmen invite to address them. I've come to the conclusion that at best, this is non-productive, and that at worst, it promotes complacency or reactionaryism. Conservatism may be highly regarded, but complacency and reactionaryism can be dangerous diseases for the businessman and his business. Through the good offices of Paul Austin and the Coca-Cola Company, the Merit Employment Association today brings you two speakers. Both are eminently qualified. I have no idea what the content of their talks may be, but somehow I have the feeling that the subject matter of neither of them will promote non-productivity or reactionaryism or complacency, but rather will contribute what will be to many of us, at least, new and thought-provoking ideas. Our first speaker is Mr. Whitney M. Young, Jr. He is a Kentuckian by birth, a graduate of Kentucky State College, a veteran of World War II. He did graduate work at MIT and the University of Minnesota. Mr. Young joined the Urban League in 1948 as Industrial Relations Secretary of the St. Paul, Minnesota affiliate. In 1950, he was named Executive Director of the Omaha Urban League and taught at the same time at the University of Nebraska School of Social Work and at Creighton University, where he received an Honorary Doctor of Laws degree in 1964. From 1954 to 1961, Mr. Young served as Dean of the Atlanta University School of Social Work. In 1961, he was appointed Executive Director of the National Urban League and holds that post today. Mr. Young was a member of the President's Committees on Youth Employment and on Equal Opportunity in the Armed Forces. He continues as a presidential appointee on the Commission of Technology, Automation, and Economic Progress, the Commission on Law Enforcement and Administration of Justice, and on the Special Presidential Task Force on Urban Affairs. He is a member of the National Advisory Council of the U.S. Office of Economic Opportunity and the Advisory Council on Vocational Education, U.S. Office of Education. Mr. Young is also President-elect of the National Conference on Social Welfare, a member of the Board of Trustees of the Eleanor Roosevelt Memorial Foundation and of the John F. Kennedy Memorial Library, and is on the Advisory Council of the New York School of Social Work, Columbia University, and the Board of the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee. He is, as I said, eminently qualified to talk with us today. May I introduce Mr. Whitney M. Young, Jr.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horsky, Mr. Alston, Mr. Gordon, Mr. Brown, and my fellow speaker who must suffer here listening to another speech. When it was mentioned that this was being taped and the secretary need not take any notes, it doesn't intimidate me exactly. It doesn't change what I'm going to say, but I am reminded of the fact that when I had the first speech tape, as I was saying it, it sounded like Adlai Stevenson, but when I heard it played back, it sounded more like Casey Stengel. I know these things happen. I'm delighted to have this opportunity of meeting with you, and especially appreciative to the Merit Employment Association and Mr. Alston, the Coca-Cola Company, for hosting the affair. One of the bright spots in the whole race relations field in recent years has been the aroused and awakened and affirmative interest on the part of American businessmen. This has been evidenced in a number of ways. As far as the National Urban League is concerned, it has been evidenced by a greater cooperation in the seeking of employees and the upgrading of Negro employees. It's been evidenced in their willingness to serve on our boards and the rather dramatic increase in the financial contributions which corporations have made to the National Urban League. In 1961, it was some $70,000 from 60 companies. Today, it's close to $1 million from 370 companies. And as I went over the list, most of the companies represented in this room are also represented on that distinguished honor roll of contributors to the National Urban League. Some we might push up their contributions a bit, but at least they are on the honor roll. But really, I am not here to praise American business, because I think if I were to be perfectly candid, I'm still not talking about an institution given its prestige and status in this country and the stake that it has. I'm not talking about an institution that is good. I'm talking about an institution that's less bad. It's got, it's moving, it has a long ways to go, but I don't want to contribute here to smug complacency. Neither do I want to get our motives mixed up. I think it was perfectly intelligent and rational and in the enlightened self-interest of business that it no longer regard race relations as a spectator sport. I think that their stake is quite high, and it's obvious. But I was also struck not so long ago by the fact that the Negro and the businessman have a great deal in common. We have a common past, in the sense that we have been both stereotyped in the past by the general press and in the minds of the general public. Some 50 years ago, the average businessman was characterized in all of the newspapers and comic strips as a very obese fella with dollar signs for eyeballs and a gray flannel suit and an ad machine for brain. And he was thought of as a person who saw people only as impersonal cogs in some kind of industrial machine. He was regarded as fairly aesthetically illiterate, not too bright a fellow without too much education and no social sensitivity. This was not done by Negroes. This is the way the general press and cartoonists characterized businessmen 50 years ago. During this same period, the Negro was also stereotyped and characterized as sort of a happy-go-lucky, a pork chop eating, watermelon chewing, simple-minded, crap shooting fella who liked to have fun on Saturday nights. So you see, we've both been victims of great stereotypes, because today we know that neither of these pictures actually fit the individuals concerned. Today, businessmen, enlightened businessmen today, are entirely different. They are socially sensitive. They participate in the civic life of their communities. They are highly intelligent people, well-trained, aesthetically literate. They are sometimes slim, and they have hair in some cases. And the old commercial image of the businessman is no longer true. Now, I say this is also true of the Negro, that the old picture doesn't quite fit, that the Negro is not that simple-minded, happy-go-lucky fellow, that he, in fact, is a very serious, dedicated fellow, like all other citizens. He has his idiots and he has his geniuses, and I think that's the way it should be. There's no reason why white people should have a monopoly on crackpots. I think if we believe in equality, then we ought to have a few among the Negroes, and we do. And that's the way it ought to be. But at any rate, now we know that the Negro is capable, if given the opportunity, of mastering complex, difficult data and subject matter. And as far as I'm concerned, I like to have fun on Monday and Tuesday nights as well as Saturday nights. So the image just doesn't fit. I think the other reason that business is vitally concerned, and rightly so, in its own enlightened self-interest, is that business cannot really function in a climate of tension and of discord, a climate of hatred where fellow citizens are afraid of each other, are afraid of disruptions and riots and all this. This is not good for America. It is not good for business. Business functions best when there's harmony and when people respect each other and when people are not afraid of each other. I think business also now recognizes that the Negro can either be a productive, constructive consumer, or he can become a destructive, dependent kind of person. That the money will either be spent for programs of rehabilitation and prevention, or that business will spend its money for crime and for welfare. Now, when I say the Negro is a producer, I've always felt this, but I never was as sure of the great contributions the Negroes can make as I was recently when I took a trip to Africa about 8 months ago, and my more recent trip to Vietnam. But in Africa, I had the unusual experience. I went over with a group of businessmen who were interested in talking about investment in Africa, business investments. They wanted me to go along to sort of give them credibility among the Africans. If they had a real live civil rights leader, this might be helpful. I wanted to go along because I wanted to see if businessmen in America could, honest goodness, invest somewhere other than in South Africa and Rhodesia. And so I was curious about this. So it was a happy kind of combination. Well, at any rate, we got on this plane, and in a matter of a few minutes, we had gone from Kennedy Airport to London, and we stayed on the same plane. And then a few hours later, we landed in a place called Nairobi in Kenya. Got off the plane, and for the first time in my life, all of the people around the plane who in the past had been white, you know, the ticket takers, the guy pushing the steps up, the people refueling, the mechanics, all of a sudden, they were Negroes, they were black. This came to me as sort of a surprise. It happened so suddenly. My first reaction was to rush up and commend them on having gotten these jobs. You know, I said, they must have an awfully good FEPC in this town. But then I realized I was in Africa, and there we changed planes and took an East African airline to go on to Entebbe in Uganda. And we were seated on the plane, tightened our seat belts. They announced the crew was coming on, and lo and behold, when they announced the captain, he and chief pilot, he turned out to be a Negro. Now, I understand that we have a few in companies and airlines around the country. It's one of our best-kept secrets, but there are a few. I had never seen one. And just to show you that even after all of my years of giving my life, arguing to people about the qualifications of Negroes, and they're just as good as anybody else, even I had been brainwashed because I felt a moment of anxiety. I suddenly said to myself, this is a heck of a time to find out I was wrong. It was the first time that my immediate future had been so directly affected by the validity of my statement. But at any rate, I quickly got over this. I said, what the heck, if he's here, he's got to be good. You know, like Jackie Robinson, he's got to be superior. Well, the interesting thing was he was. Not just in the mechanics of touchdown and takeoff and routine flight, all this is pretty routine, but in the beautiful flow of first Oxford English and then beautiful Parisian French, as he described the topography, the economics, the culture, the language of the country. It was a beautiful lecture that would have done justice to Georgia State or Emory or Agnes Scott or something. And then I got to this meeting, and there during the course of that week, I saw the few people in Africa, native Africans, who'd had a chance for education and gotten their PhDs from London School of Economics or from American colleges. And I saw them there discussing with the best minds from Western Europe and from the United States the latest theories in economics and in educational development and agricultural development and in business and business investment. And they were not only equal to the very best from these other countries, but in their substantive discussions, but in the protocol and the niceties, the nuances that go on in these things. And my first reaction was one of disgust, because I said, my God, what we have cost ourselves in this world through our inability to see beneath the color of a man's skin. that we probably would have had today a cure for cancer and for the common cold or for heart trouble if somehow we hadn't written off a whole group of people and denied them an opportunity for an education because of their color. And everybody suffers, but it's not Urban League-like to be negative, so I began to think positively what a great potential exists in this world. If we can somehow free ourselves of this notion that little thin layer of skin makes a difference in what's in a man's head or what's in his heart. And if we can get over that, then we can unleash not just human potential for good deeds, but we can unleash some brains and minds that are capable of making contributions to all of us. But you don't have to go to Africa. It happens right in every community in which you live, right in Atlanta. There are children here who have great potential. I think business is beginning to realize that. It's no longer just a question, well, I got to comply with Title VII, or I'll lose my defense contract, or I may be picketed or boycotted, may be set up. I think business is beyond this. I think business now knows that this Negro can be the source of a great consumer demand as well as a very valuable person in his plant. Now, it isn't going to be easy for some people to do these things. I think I would make several suggestions based on my experience. I've had the chance in the last 2 years to talk to personally and certainly in group with at least 400 of Fortune's top 500 top executives of the corporations. And I have found these men to be vitally interested, but I have found some popular misconceptions, and I have found some mistakes, and I have found some attitudes that can stand in our way if we aren't careful. One, I run into this notion that the Negro must be superior, that we're willing to hire him, but he's got to be better. And I submit to you this is terribly unfair and terribly unrealistic to expect a race of people who've had generations of slavery, who've had generations of being denied the barest minimum in economic and health and educational opportunities. To produce superior people is really an unfair assumption. But people still come to me and they say, I'll hire a secretary if you can find somebody who looks like Lena Horne and who types 120 words a minute. Or I can hire an accountant if he's got the background of Ralph Bunch. Well, now, we run out of these kind of people pretty fast in the Negro group. I'm hiring most of them myself if I can find them. So what we got to do is to begin to hire just average Negroes like we hire average white people. And those jobs that we set aside for dumb white people, let us have a few of those too, because we have Negroes who aren't all Einsteins. And so we want some of those set aside across the board, and don't ask us to provide the impossible. Secondly, I think it's awfully important that we don't let these extracurricular things change our minds. For example, I've had people in recent days say to me, well, I was all with your people until these riots started, or until they started shouting black power. And now I'm sort of disenchanted. Now, this bothers me to no end, that people would seize upon the actions of a few to condemn and to generalize about a whole race of people. The Negro has never done this. We have never generalized about all white people based on the activities of the Klan, are based upon the fact that white people enslaved us, or that some white people have been brutal and have jailed us and have beat us. We've never generalized about all white people based on the fact that a white man in Chicago murders 8 nurses, or that a man stands on a tower in Texas and shoots 12 or 13 people. That's an individual. That's not all white people. And I submit to you that what you see in the streets and the newspapers have an obsession with reporting the negatives does not represent anywhere near all Negroes. For every one kid that throws a rock in Chicago or in Watts, there are 100 Negro boys in Vietnam, and in many cases volunteering in Vietnam, fighting and dying for this country. And instead of telling Negro citizens we are not going to pass a civil rights bill, or we're not going to do something because 100 people are rioting. It would be so much better to say we are going to do something. We are going to pass a bill. We are going to take some action because 60,000 Negro boys are over in Vietnam fighting for all of us. Now, I saw some of the best qualified human beings that I've ever seen in my life over in Vietnam. These Negro soldiers over there are not, they're not our addicts, they're not our rejects, our functional illiterates. This represents the cream of the crop. These fellows are in positions of great responsibility. Many have enlisted, and it's to their credit, but it's a sad commentary on our society that a man feels that he can get more dignity and more economic security and more opportunity for promotion in the muck and mire of Vietnam than he can in the civilian life of our country. And my reason for going mainly, other than to say to these fellows, we are proud of you and we are concerned about you, my real reason for going was to set in motion machinery for a reentry of these fellows back into civilian life. And I've asked business groups already, we will be asking more, that as we set this machinery up, and many of these fellows are from the South, that you will take advantage of it, that you will not let these fellows come back and find that the thing that they sacrificed so much for 10,000 miles away from home does not exist right in their own hometown. And I hope you will make a special effort to include them. Third, I would hope that you would keep in mind the necessity for firmness at the top and for follow through. It's one thing to sign the president's plans for progress. It's another thing to put out an ad saying I'm a fair employment practices company. It's another thing to say I'm a member of the Merit Employment Volunteer Association. It's another thing to put in your ads that you're fair employment. But there are many of your employees down the line where they think this is just complying with the rules and playing the game like it's supposed to be played. And they have no intention of following through. And we have had more companies remain lily white. And the man upstairs can't understand why he doesn't have any Negroes moving up into top jobs or nobody applying. When one little receptionist in a personnel office, simply by letting a Negro applicant stand there too long, or by saying to him, what do you want? And that's all that's needed for people who have had doors slammed in their face. And I would implore you, not just in your own mind, in your own written memos, to articulate your policies, but in fact follow through all the way down the line to see that in fact that receptionist and all the people above that receptionist know that you are sincere. In the final analysis, it will be how many Negroes we see there, whether you are actually going all out. Now, this calls for a special effort. It just can't be I've opened the doors. And I've been criticized for saying this. I continue to say it. I do think that today, if we are going to actually get Negro employees, we've got to go beyond saying, well, now we are no longer discriminating. Now the doors are open. We've got to make a special effort. Well, I don't want to tell you what to do. Let me tell you what we did in the Urban League. Up until I came to the Urban League in 1961, 99% of our staff were Negroes. Now, I knew why. It was mainly because you couldn't find many well-balanced, well-motivated white people who wanted to work in race relations. There were a few crackpots, or a few missionaries, or a few people who had political axes to grind. And you couldn't find any other jobs for Negroes who had talent but the Urban League. But now all of this has changed. Today it is the most intelligent, the most enlightened white people, the soundest, the best motivated, the Phi Beta Kappas, the top people in public relations, advertising, personnel who want to work with the Urban League. And so we can get top people. And Negroes today who are talented can get other jobs. Every company wants at least one instant Negro or one, you know, Exhibit A. So we can get those. Now, I wanted to change the policy, the practices. Now, here's what we did. And there's no, if you want to take notes, there's no patent on this at all to reverse it. What we did was to first sign the president's plans for progress. Said we were a fair employment agency and we didn't discriminate. And we accepted all applicants regardless of race, creed, or color. made us feel very good, and this increased our number from 1% to 2%. So then we took the second step, and we began some affirmative action in recruiting. And what we did was not to go to Tuskegee and Howard and Atlanta University and look for white people. We went where white people were, and we went to their schools, and we talked to them and begged and pleaded with them and tried to get them to come work with us, and this helped us. We moved up to about 4%. And then this wasn't nearly enough, so we took the third step. I sent out a memorandum to all of our personnel people. We have over 1,000 people employed. And I said, until further notice, if two people equally qualified apply, one white and one Negro, hire the white person. Now, I knew this was kind of discrimination and preferential treatment, but I wanted to get white people, and I felt for a while we'd have to do this. We'd have to make this special effort. This took us up to about 7%, but of course, this isn't representative in the general population. So I had our research department look into this. And they said, you know, the problem is, after doing a study, is that most white people don't meet our standards. That, you see, we wrote these tests. We made up this criteria. So what, and I'm not being facetious, we had a criteria in there. We said that we wanted people, among other things, who knew what it meant to be rejected, who'd had a door slammed in their face, who'd been told, go up in the balcony, or you can't come in this restaurant, or you can't come in this plant, or take this job as a janitor, even though you got a PhD. We wanted people who understood the language of the ghetto and who knew the psychology of the poor. And I think that's a reasonable kind of qualification for our kind of work. But obviously, white people couldn't meet this standard. Now, what did we do? Did we stand back and say, do you want us to lower our standard? No. We took a hard look at our whole set of testing procedures and screening procedures, and we said these people have some other things that we do want. And so we took some of the weight off of this other thing, which white people couldn't obviously meet, you know, like Negroes can't meet experience requirements. And we added some weight onto some of these other things. And then we set up a remedial program, and we hired white people. I remember David Russ, Dean Russ's son, came in about 3 years ago under that program, and Adrian Zucker, the former Secretary of the Air Force's daughter. I'm deliberately name-dropping to let you know these are top Phi Beta Kappas from Harvard and other places. And we set up this program where for 6 months, we provided them, it was a provisional program, with remedial kinds of experiences in an effort to bring them up to our standards. And I want to announce to you, this is a success story, that they have turned out to be as good, if not better, than many of our Negro employees. And today, instead of 1%, we have 30%. You see, we wanted to hire white people. And we figured if you want to do it, you can be as creative about doing it as you were creative about not doing it for many years. And we could have used all the same old excuses, you know, about they might be lonely, or nobody applies, or what about our Christmas party? You know, we could have had all the same kind of excuses that I've heard so many times, but we didn't want that. Now, if we can do this with our limited experience being boss, you see, we haven't been boss for very long. What can business do with this long period of creative management and personnel practices? Now, this is what we're asking by way of special effort. Well, finally, and I don't want to take too much time here, the other speaker, I do want to impress upon you that business has a role beyond the employment of people. You are, for better or for worse, for good or for evil, these status symbols in America, in the kind of society in which we live, and here I pass no judgment on our judgment on it, but nevertheless it's true. You are the opinion makers. You're the standard setters. You're the people who set the kind of patterns that a community will follow. This means that it's very foolish, if not hypocritical, for you to be talking about you will employ people and doing nothing about what the local school situation looks like. For you to stand back and say, well, I think I'll hire Negroes, and yet Negroes are receiving absolutely no kind of preparation in their vocational schools or their high schools or their colleges to equip them to come into your business, then this is hypocritical. If you're doing nothing about housing, which has so much to do with schools, here kids have a chance to study and to learn, if you're doing nothing about strengthening family life, then you see you aren't really, in the final analysis, going to get a stable, well-balanced, well-qualified employee. Business must be concerned about education. It must be concerned about housing. It must be concerned, as it is concerned, about all aspects of community life. You pay the taxes in this community more than anybody else. And this is why it is so basic. And you must support responsible Negro leadership. If you know nothing else today, I hope you know that this movement is either going in one direction or the other, depending on which Negro leads that movement, which organization, and which philosophy. Now, the Urban League in this town has been piddling around with peanuts. It's been getting such a low amount from the chest compared to the problem, the size of the Negro population, that it's a shame. You could have one little incident in this town, and the Urban League has probably prevented thousands, that overnight could cost the community $1 million overnight. It did $70 million in Watts in a week. Now, this organization ought not be trying to make it on $50,000 or $60,000. In communities all over this country today, the Urban League budget has been quadrupled, because here's an organization that is trying to channel these frustrations, this impatience, into constructive lines. We're saying to people, look, power doesn't come from chanting a slogan. Power is the green of a dollar bill. It's the maroon of a textbook. It's a ballot in the ballot box. And what you got to do is go to school. And these are the kind of programs we run: counseling, guidance, strengthening family life, getting people off of relief, stopping dropouts. And this program, which you support through your community chest, has got to be strengthened. And don't wait for a catastrophe, for a tragedy, and say, well, we'd better give the Urban League more money. This is your best bet. You will either support substantially responsible Negro leadership, or else irresponsible leadership will take over. And that's why you've got to get behind it. Now, I would hope that you'd get involved in this problem for all of the reasons I'd mentioned. Economic, international, your own enlightened self-interest. But most of all, I hope you get involved in it, and I mean meaningfully, because it's right. This problem isn't going to solve itself by time, the ticking of a clock. The ticking of a clock never brought about a single social reform. It will solve itself because of people. People who have conviction. We didn't get Negroes in baseball because we suddenly found a Negro who could run bases and hit a ball and who had some intelligence, named Jackie Robinson. We had Jackie Robinson 50 years before a Negro got into baseball. Just like we had T.M. Alexander's here for years. But the difference was, we didn't have a Branch Rickey. And that made the difference. And Branch Rickey said, this I have got to do because it's right. It's not an all-American game, it's an all-American white game. And when everybody said, oh, Mr. Rickey, don't rock the boat, he said, I got to live with myself. And nobody quit. You know, everybody said the customers were going to walk out, and every time Jackie hit a home run, he got whiter. And they just applauded and everything. And the boys from Mississippi didn't run off back to Mississippi. They reflected on that $20 a week job picking cotton in Mississippi, and they looked at that World Series check, and they grabbed Jackie and just hugged him, you know, when he helped them get in the World Series. Oh, it works. It works, but you have to have some conviction. But the most important thing is what Branch Rickey's son said to me once. He said, my father could leave me anything, but he's leaving me the most important thing. Not wealth, not property. But he's leaving me a name that stands for courage and conviction and integrity and decency. Your fathers, your grandfathers, your husbands. Our kids today, including mine, are very much concerned about human relations. And you can either stand as tall as a giant or as small as a pygmy in their eyes if you're doing something on this problem. They may never tell you, but they tell me every day in colleges all over this country that my father is always telling me I don't have to drink or smoke or pet because everybody else does. But after all, I have my own value system. I know right from wrong, stand up for what I believe in. I know you tell them this. I tell my 19-year-old daughter at Bryn Mawr the same thing. And then these kids say to me, but my parents never stand up for what is right. They never lift their finger to get a Negro in their office, in the neighborhood, in the school. So on trial is more than the Negro. On trial is more than business or churches or education institutions. On trial is more than America and the validity of the free enterprise system. On trial happens to be each and every one of us. We are talking to Negroes every day and trying to get them to do their job. But in many ways, I think you must admit that the Negro has said in a thousand ways throughout history, we believe in America. He said it in fighting in every war. He said it by his patience, by his still crying out, turn the other cheek and love thy neighbor in the face of such great brutalities and humiliations and discrimination. I think the time has come, and I think by your presence here today that you are going to help us say to the American Negro that you believe in him. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Whitney Young. For the first 3 or 4 minutes there, in view of my opening remarks, I thought you were going to let me down. I'd like to introduce our other speaker now. Dr. Michael H. Mescon is Professor of Human Relations and Chairman of the Department of Management in the School of Business Administration at Georgia State College. Of special interest is the fact that he holds the only chair of private enterprise in the United States. His undergraduate and master's degrees are from the University of Miami, his PhD from New York University. Dr. Mescon is the author of approximately 40 articles and co-author of the book Organization and Enterprise. His article Motivation and the Manager was selected Best Article of the Year in 1963 by the Training Directors Journal in the category Training Theory and Research. In 1961, he was selected by Industrial Development Magazine as one of the South's outstanding young leaders. In 1963, the Atlanta Junior Chamber of Commerce named him Outstanding Young Man of the Year in Education. In 1964, he received an American Economic Foundation Award for work in economic education through the chair of private enterprise. Dr. Mescon was in the U.S. Army from 1954 to 1956. He has occupied both line and staff positions in industry and has served in consulting, training, and lecturing capacities for over 60 organizations representing business, industry, and governmental activities. Dr. Mescon.
Thank you very much, Mr. Horsey. I would initially like to thank our host very much and also like to comment on the very fine food we had for lunch. I don't think I had anything like that roast beef, sir, since I left Fort Jackson. It was really unusual, and I want to indicate my basic feeling to you initially. You know, actually, if we were good capitalists, there'd be no meeting. There'd be no reason, no basis for a meeting like this today. And actually, we might be better capitalists if perhaps we understood the nature, the essence, the substance of capitalism just a little bit better. And let's take a look for just a few moments at capitalism, or private enterprise, if you wish. And let's strip aside the facade. Let's look at its basic elements, and let's see how each one of us, individually and collectively, are inextricably bound to this system. Now, the essential ingredients of capitalism, of private enterprise, would be a total culture, the matter of individual interests, competition, and finally, profit. In short, properly blended, effectively mixed, private enterprise represents a total culture, a system where the individual and individual interests operate in a competitive market environment for one basic purpose, and that is to effect a profit. And I think we have to recognize that profit represents to the business organization and to the business organizations represented in this room today what the satisfaction of biological needs represent to the individual, that is, survival. Now, I think the key to this whole definition of capitalism is the fact that the individual is paramount. Capitalism, of all of the other isms, recognizes that the individual is endowed with a kind of godlike dignity that he is something special, that he is more than just another factor of production. Now, unfortunately, this last factor has been forgotten. And in my opinion, the omission of this last factor, the relegation of the individual to a secondary position, represents to capitalism today its greatest threat. In most of our organizations, we have taken the individual and this whole concept of individual differences, and we have relegated it to a kind of philosophical limbo. And once again, I want to indicate to you that the perpetuation of a system of capitalism will not necessarily begin in the schools or the religious institutions or the homes, but must in effect be actually implemented by business leaders and business organizations all over these United States today. Unfortunately, the fact of the matter is that the recognition of individual differences today is far more of a maintenance factor than it is an incentive factor. And this thing of individual differences transcends, this problem transcends race, religion, ethnic group. It is a problem that totally encompasses every phase of organized activity today, where, in effect, the ability of the individual to survive rather than the ability of the individual to perform is becoming a major criterion for recognition, advancement, and promotion. We have created within the framework of our structures today, and it doesn't matter whether we're talking about business organizations, schools, religious institutions, hospitals, we have created that type of situation today where we as businessmen accept the unsatisfactory performer, where we tolerate the individual who simply gets by, but where we are unable to cope with a rate buster. That is the individual who wants to exceed, the individual who wants to perform in a superior fashion. In addition, our present personnel practices in this particular area often reflect top management thinking. And this thinking in so many instances is not geared to the demands of the job, but is based upon unrealistic stereotypes, fully out of touch with reality. As a matter of fact, and this relates directly to many comments made by the previous speaker, one of our major problems today in business, in industry, and in government is the fact that we have established employment standards which are unrealistic. We have made educational demands which are totally out of touch with job requirements. And we have created that sort of situation through ineffective selection and placement where the vast majority of our employees are actually underemployed. They are not being challenged. Their attitude, to a great extent, is steeped in a kind of morbid preoccupation, which is the net result of our not doing an effective job of matching the demands of the job with the skills of the individual. Now, once more, this relates basically to the role, to the function that each one of us must play. Now, I indicated to you that the blame for this must of necessity rest with top management. Now, why do I say this? You see, in any organization, and I mean any organization in our society, behavior is a reflective type of phenomenon. The individual at the top is the pattern setter. The individual at the bottom, the individual who occupies a lower position in the hierarchy, behaves in many instances according to the way he thinks the top man wants him to behave. So this matter of recognizing employment opportunities as an individual phenomenon must actually originate by top management and must be fully implemented within the framework of our organizations, and this, unfortunately,
is where a major lag exists. I have not talked with a responsible administrator in business, industry, government, the military, who would not fully and totally agree with everything that I have said. They recognize that the basic tenet, or a basic tenet, of private enterprise is that of recognizing people as individuals, gearing compensation to contribution, but in the final analysis, when the moment of truth arises, we take all of these concepts, we shove them under the rug, and we rationalize that we must do this because the implementation of these policies, of these procedures, of these principles are administratively unfeasible. Now, the fact of the matter is, they're quite feasible. The fact of the matter is that proper recognition of the individual, proper selection, proper training, proper incorporation of the individual within the framework of the organization is good business. It leads to that sort of situation where the organization is able to affect a profit while the individual at the same time is able to affect a profit. And this, my friends, is good capitalism. You want to create that sort of situation where a fusion process takes place, where we have a double plus, where we do that sort of selection, that sort of training, that sort of placement, where the individual, not the group, but where the individual feels as if he is inextricably bound to what happens to this organization. When you have this sort of situation, you have high productivity, you reduce your turnover, you reduce your absenteeism, you reduce your waste. In other words, you create a highly profitable type of situation. Now, in order to do this, we're going to have to remove several stumbling blocks that exist today. Specifically, we have organizational rigidity in a dynamic climate. There exists a tremendous cultural lag between what we believe, what we accept, and what we implement. There is a failure to exercise creative capitalism, which depicts change not as an end, but rather as a vehicle that preserves the best, scraps the rest, and devotes its energies to the emancipation of the responsive and responsible individual. And this is a basic function of any person who wants to cloak himself in the mantle of capitalism. Because capitalism as an ideology is directed towards the total unleashing of the individual human being. Now, self-enlightened management today must be a moving force, and unfortunately, it has been loath to move. It must be a vital agent, a critical agent of social control that is capable of affecting a profit for not only the organization, but the individual. You know, interestingly enough, in 1911, Frederick W. Taylor, the individual that we revere as the father of scientific management, said in his initial work that the basic object of management should be to secure maximum profit for the employer coupled with maximum profit for the employee, and that is exactly what I'm talking about today. We as individuals must create that situation where a profit for the organization and a profit for the individual becomes an integral part of our thinking. Now, unless management can do this, it is engendering that sort of situation, and we see it today, where power is centralized rather than diffused, and where individual initiative is likely to join the American buffalo as a living relic. The fact of the matter is, we tend to be vacuum creators. Now, you know as well as I do that nature abhors a vacuum. When one exists, something will come and fill it up. And when I talk about creative capitalism, I am talking about a force that does not create these vacuums. We have seen over and over again that when these vacuums are created, They are inevitably and invariably filled by doctrines, ideologies, concepts, movements, beliefs that in most instances are diametrically opposed to what it is we say we stand for. So my plea to you is to exercise that sort of creative capitalism, that kind of dynamic private enterprise that eliminates these vacuum-creating situations. What we need today, succinctly, is an aristocracy based upon ability where status is achieved, not ascribed. And this, to me, is the key to this thing of capitalism. If we want to look at it from a merchandising, from a marketing perspective, can you imagine the excitement, the interest, the vitality that can be created by presenting capitalism for what it is, an aristocracy based upon achievement, where status is achieved, not ascribed, where the rate buster, the superior individual, the person who wants to work, is revered, not rejected, and a cultural climate where attainment is far more important than acceptance. Now, for this, we need a new kind of business leader. And I use business here in its most generic sense. I'm talking about any kind of administrator. Whether this individual runs a college or whether he runs a large industrial complex or a hospital or a military organization. We need an individual who stands for personal excellence in an era of sameness. An individual who is willing to exercise commitment in an enterprise which worships too often compromise. Honesty in a society more often dedicated to the preservation of tradition above truth. In short, we need that type of leadership which will shepherd us, which will lead us to recognize that the answer is not the removal of individual challenge, but rather the endorsement of civilized competition where education and skill, rather than ethnic origin and seniority, are the major determinants of success. You know, we need heroes rather than manipulators. Men who understand that a permanent nexus or link must exist between the drive for authority and the willingness to accept responsibility. We need that kind of creative person who recognizes that change today is the status quo, and by recognizing this, shapes rather than perpetuates. I certainly want to congratulate all of the members of this organization for what it is that they are doing. I strongly and firmly believe that if businessmen like yourself had taken action like this many years ago, that we would not have, for example, created the many vacuum-creating situations that have led to legislation, to regulation, and to our handling what is basically a human problem in a legalistic fashion. And I sincerely hope that you will continue to function as bellwethers, and that you will continue to make an honest and sincere attempt to close the gap between the basic theoretical tenets of capitalism and what we do in the real world of business. I want to thank you very, very much for your attention, for your responsiveness, and I certainly hope and trust that I shall have the opportunity of talking with all of you again, collectively and individually. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned.